NWP Radio.
You're listening to NWP Radio, a production of the National Writing Project.
NWP.
Welcome, listeners. This is NWP Radio, a production of the National Writing Project. Today is June 7th, 2018, and tonight we're talking with four of the co-authors of the book Real Writing, Modernizing the Old School Essay. I'm your host, Rachel Baer, and tonight I'm pleased to have several guests to talk with us. I'd like to welcome Mitch Nobis. Mitch is a teacher and writer in the Metro Detroit area. He's a co-director of the Red Cedar Writing Project, and for another few weeks, the president of Michigan Council of Teachers of English. He has over 20 years of classroom experience. We also have Carrie Nobis with us. Carrie is a high school science and English teacher in Metro Detroit and a teacher consultant with the Red Cedar Writing Project. We also have Don Reed. Don is a secondary English teacher in the Greater Lansing area and co-director of Red Cedar Writing Project. She writes about teaching writing, and she is inspired by authentic inquiry and writing driven by life experiences. Finally, we have Dirk Schultz with us. Dirk is a former Outward Bound instructor who has now been teaching and writing and trying to bring the tenets of experiential education into high school classrooms in Northern Virginia for almost two decades. And the fifth co-author of the book, Daniel Laird, wasn't able to be with us tonight. But thank you and welcome to all of you. Happy to have you here.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you, Rachel.
No problem. Thank you. So to get us started, I want to talk a little bit about the title of the book. So the title of the book is Real Writing. So when we say real writing, what do we mean by that?
Really just that this book generated out of a professional development session that we led together that was essentially in response to the need to stop doing so many five-paragraph essays and formulaic approaches in the classroom. And it didn't even necessarily start as a treatise against five-paragraph essays so much as we were talking about how so often teachers tend to give assignments like, you know, well, we need to do a persuasive piece, so argue about dress codes, even though the school doesn't have dress codes, you know, things like that. And they're disingenuous topics that get to, you know, disingenuous writing. And basically that was kind of the motivator for us, was what are different things that we already do and can do to get kids writing authentically, you know, authentic topics, authentic audiences, get some legitimate purpose behind their writing. And I think that this will probably come up again more as the show goes on, but yeah, I'm really kind of proud of our work because we wrote this thing, well, guys, 2015, 16, I don't know, a while ago. And since then, you can see just across the nation, like students now are very, very engaged in authentic topics and are using their written and spoken voices. So, you know, we're certainly not the only people out there talking about this topic right now. But that's the idea. Real world. Kids are in the real world, so write about real topics.
Yeah, I think largely what we were concerned with as a group and in our conversations, not only with each other, but with the other teachers with whom we work, is that there is this disconnect between what teachers so often ask students to write about and what students are interested in, and what teachers ask students to write about in the world that the students actually inhabit. And whether it's something, as Mitch pointed out, like asking students to write about dress codes when their school doesn't have a dress code, or even not trying to find ways to connect the writing that students do with the lives that they're actually living, and doing everything we can to bring the world that the students live in into the classroom, rather than trying to pretend that the classroom is one world and once they leave the doors of the school, the students inhabit some other world that we can't acknowledge and they can't acknowledge.
The other aspect of real writing is writing in a way that exists in the real world. And a lot of the writing that teachers are asking their students or have been asking their students in the past to do is very formulaic and doesn't exist outside of the classroom. And we're hoping to make a push toward getting writing in the classroom that more closely resembles some of the writing that happens in the real world.
All of which ideally will lead to students who see themselves as individuals who can actually be engaged not only in the world of school, but also with the world outside of school, because it's the same world, and thus having students who are actually civically engaged.
I was going to say a very similar thing. It's almost like there's spoiler alert for our book is that, you know, teenagers live on the same earth that adults do.
Yeah, I have a colleague who I work with who says often this thing about civically engaged writing and this idea that the classroom's not the real world, like we're doing things in school to prepare them for the real world. And he said, actually, the classroom is the real world. That is their world. And if we're always thinking about preparing them for this thing that's later, we're not actually engaging them in conversations that are happening in the world. And like you said, that they really care about.
Right. Yeah. And we're not honoring them as participants in the world. We're pretending that they don't exist in it. Mm-hmm. And if you've read any interviews with or discussions with older adults, and I count myself now, for better or for worse, as an older adult, and the question comes up of what gives you hope for the future, the adults right now are all saying it's those students who are civically engaged, who have recognized that their world is the world and they are absolutely a part of it and they have a voice in how it's run.
So is there anything, Dawn, that you would add about this idea of civic engagement and what we mean by that and your experience with this kind of writing in your classroom?
Sure. Thank you, Rachel. So everything that everyone's been saying, of course, I wholeheartedly agree with. And, you know, a lot of times I think when we talk about civic engagement, sometimes for an English classroom, teachers are thinking about literature that's been published a while ago, and there's definitely ways to make connections to today. Of course, today in my classroom alone, we were talking about The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, and my students were diving into what Twain would have to say about the world in 2018, and then what they had to say about the world in 2018. And so one way that I've involved students in thinking about civic engagement is with a project I call This I Wish to Change, and that has been developed over years with collaborations with numerous writing project teachers. And a big piece of that is asking students to say, what are the issues in front of you that you want to be involved in? And one of the things that I found over time is that students start off with these grand ideas related to what they think adults want to hear. I'm going to solve world hunger. I'm going to create world peace. And then they don't stop and think about the smaller things that they can do or what pressing issue is right in front of them. And sometimes that pressing issue right in front of them is something school related that needs to happen to support students, or it's something related to writing a letter about an issue that they care about. And oftentimes I think students just are sort of reaching for this grand thing that to answer questions we want to hear, and not realizing they have something to say about numerous issues to write about as well, which of course ties into all kinds of things like the role of argument and other conversations, including several that are being connected to other various and National Writing Project conversations. So this year, for instance, my students watched the PBS documentary American Creed and had a lot of conversation around how the documentary prompts them to think about how people struggle in our country to talk about a lot of issues that we have and what they can do about those issues. And so there's a website, Writing Your Future, that highlights a lot of that work that students have been doing and thinking about what are some of their stories in the country and what do they hope our country will be.
Great, thank you, Dawn. And I think that's such an important point that this book is, you know, you're a few years ahead of the curve and just very timely right now in things that people are thinking about and invitations for students to become civically engaged in topics that matter and to make reasoned arguments about topics that matter. I'm glad you mentioned American Creed, Dawn. We also have a number of teachers who are probably listening who have been involved in various C3WP College Career and Community Writers program initiatives who will see connections here between this, what you write about in the book and civic engagement, as well as also these real world writing where we see connections between what you were thinking about a few years ago and movements that are happening now. So thank you for that introduction and starting to think about what we mean by real writing. And Mitch, you mentioned this early on that in many ways the book itself is, addresses the five paragraph essay and sort of rolls right into the five paragraph essay and makes the claim that, you know, that there are better ways. And so I would be interested in hearing more about your thinking behind why not the five paragraph essay. You know, what is your thinking there? And I'm wondering if you'll get us started here, Dirk, because you write a vignette in one of the chapters about your experience as a student with the five paragraph essay and what happened when you confronted it for the first time.
Well, it was really the first time I considered the possibility of fighting against the five paragraph essay. And we talk about the idea of the five paragraph essay as the idea of both an extremely formulaic approach to writing, which you don't tend to see in the quote, real world, unquote, as well as a form of writing in which a student is encouraged to develop a conclusion before he's really thought about the question itself or the possible complexities of the question. And also a form of writing in which a student has little to no interest in the topic that's being discussed. It's a little bit like the way that, and I apologize for this, but it's the way that Marx thinks about how the working class engages with his labor, that it's just not a part of a man's life at all. It's something that he has to do. And so I was a senior in high school. I enrolled in an English class, and we were assigned what amounted to a persuasive essay. And we were given more than the usual 45 to 90 minutes to write this persuasive essay. And so I took the time that we had to actually think about a topic that I was interested in and that I felt I might have a stake in both right now and in the future. And I wasn't sure what the answer to the question that I was asking would be, but I did as much research as I could and I found out what I could. And I wrote a lengthy response to the question that I was asking. And I turned it in excited that for the first time I felt in my high school English career, I had really engaged with a topic in a meaningful fashion. And I didn't do it for a grade, but to be honest, I was expecting a pretty good grade on it. I figured, like, if I got B's for the things that I did without caring about, like, now that I actually care about this and that I tried, like, this might finally be an A in an English class. And I got it back, and the grade was lower than I expected, not just a B, but actually one of the worst grades that I had ever gotten on an English assignment. And the comment that the teacher made to sort of justify the grade, or the commentary that the teacher had to justify the grade, pointed out what had become for me, and I think for a lot of my colleagues, the problems with this formulaic approach to writing, which is, number one, I didn't state my conclusion in the introduction. Number two, I didn't have three body paragraphs, each one presenting a single simplistic point in support of the conclusion that I had already drawn. And when I reached my conclusion, I didn't simply restate what I had put in my introduction. And I thought, all right, apparently I misunderstood what writing is. I see and I read writing in other places, and that's just not what we do in school. And I went off to college, and I wrote a paper for my freshman seminar, the first writing class that I had as a college student. And I wrote it according to my understanding of what writing was, where you state a simplistic thesis in your introduction, you have three simplistic body paragraphs that support it, and a conclusion that restates what you said only 750 words ago, as if anybody's forgotten it. And the professor gave me my paper back, and in the lengthy commentary he had stapled to the end of the paper, he wrote, and this is the very first comment that I got on a college paper, "This is an acceptable paper, but one in which the writer has worked well within his limits. I hope to see more in the future." And he went on to explain exactly what that meant. But that was the moment that I realized that maybe I hadn't been wrong my senior year of high school, and that maybe there was more to writing than expressing a pseudo interest in something that you don't actually care about, and then concluding something simplistic about that pseudo interest.
Are we pausing here for applause as the listener? I'm going to chime in and connect that to our book's title, which is a very silly thing to do after that awesome story. And really, we should probably take a very quick tangent here to mention that Dirk and I are old friends. We actually met our freshman year in college, and we were in that class. So 40% of this book should be dedicated to Walter Clark, because he set us on the right path, man. I mean, we would not be having these thoughts right now probably without Walter. Well, if you're out there, Walter, thank you. So the book, I'm going to nerd out on the grammar of our book title for a second. It's very purposefully not hyphenated. We're not ripping on old school writing, you know, a la old school hip hop or that use of the phrase. Quite the opposite. I mean, in the book we get into, you know, the Michel de Montaigne invented this whole genre, right? So like old essays are good essays. Francis Bacon still kicks butt. But that if you look at those old essays, and like Carrie said earlier, you connect it to contemporary writing, especially like Don was saying, you know, civic stuff that connects civically. They're not following those formulas. They're much more closely following Montaigne's. If he had a formula, it would be like his approach, right? Which is to tie another thread back together. What Dirk was just saying, that the what we think of as the introduction in a kind of academic essay, the five paragraph format anyways, the introduction is usually the conclusion of a quote unquote real essay. You know, the writer establishes a line of thinking and then investigates it and explores it and, you know, elucidates it, adds examples, etc., and then really doesn't tell the reader what you're thinking until the very end, which is exactly what, you know, old, you know, model essays did, the quote unquote old school with a hyphen. So our title very purposely doesn't have the hyphen, because what we're upset about is the old fashioned essays that we just do in school. So that's, I'm going to give the nerdy follow-up to Dirk's awesome story to basically point out that that's our five paragraph thing in a nutshell. I have seen teachers use five paragraph essays adequately and even well, but they're very quick lessons before they move on to much more complex, real world, connected, authentic writing invitations to their students.
Yeah, I was actually going to ask just about that, Mitch, because you all point out that, you know, teachers' motivations for teaching the five paragraph essay won't surprise any of us, that they do that for good intentions, right? To provide accessible opportunities for students, to help them think about writing in a way that's simple enough for them to understand and as an entry point. And you point this out, and I often hear teachers say that the five paragraph essay or other formulas for writing are really training wheels for students that are then removed. But what I think often happens is that those training wheels aren't necessarily removed, that movement to other kinds of essays doesn't necessarily happen. And so I can see people thinking like, okay, so you've made a really good case for why not the five paragraph essay, but if we're going to teach these more like complex and messy types of real world writing. How do we do that? What are the best approaches to that? Maybe Carrie, would you jump in with some thoughts about what you might say in response to that? Like, how do we teach this real writing to students?
Well, I do think to start off that one of the big motivations for teaching the 5-paragraph essay, in addition to providing those training wheels, is that they're easy to assess. And one of the things we address in our book is moving toward assessing for thinking as opposed to assessing for structure. And that is a big shift for a lot of teachers, but a really important one. There are some great writers out there. Maya Wilson is one that I can think of, who kind of rails against using rubrics to keep writing contained in a little box. And that's something that we wholeheartedly agree with. As far as approaches to actually teaching beyond that 5-paragraph essay, it really starts with exposing students to reading essays that are not 5-paragraph essays. And so often in English classes, we are separating our writing instruction from our reading instruction. We're asking students to write essays without having had students read essays. And I think, Mitch, you might have some comments here on how to use contemporary essays and real essays that are engaging and well-written to mentor students as they learn to write themselves.
Yeah, I think this is also a very cool connection with some other National Writing Project work, because if you take a quick glance, you know, through recent history, we're writing this in 2015, I think it would have been, which in hindsight is the exact same time that NWP was coming up with College Career and Community Writing Program, which is largely doing the same thing. And a lot of us were doing the same thing at the same time, it turns out, which is to say, like, have students read contemporary writing instead of just assigning textbook pieces. You may be using a textbook in your district, but to supplement that with, you know, Leonard Pitts is a popular one that comes up a lot in teacher Twitter chats, for example. In the book, we mentioned Ta-Nehisi Coates because literally as we were writing the first draft of this was the Emmanuel AME church shooting. And the next day he wrote an essay about the impact of the Confederate flag for the Atlantic Monthly. He wrote for the Atlantic Monthly an essay about taking down the Confederate flag. And they did. South Carolina took the Confederate flag down from their state house within days. And it's not that Coates' essay was the only thing that made that happen, but when the governor was talking about it, like, they kind of cited that the essay did have an impact, that it brought a certain weight and merit to that discussion on the table at that time. And if you read the essay, it's a phenomenal essay. It doesn't even remotely resemble a 5-paragraph essay. Short, choppy paragraphs. Its last two paragraphs are one sentence long. The next to last one is the claim. You know, it's buried at the very end. But buried's not even the right word, because the piece moves, the pace is so urgent in the essay that you can't help but get there. So why wouldn't we ask students to read essays like that? Like, this is a very much in the headlines news story. We've got an award-winning essayist tackling it. It's just common sense to do that.
Yeah, and when you ask students to look at that essay, they pick up very quickly on its structure and how effective its structure is. You know, the last sentence of the first paragraph, which ostensibly would be the conclusion in a formulaic essay, is something to the effect of the Confederate flag still flies over the Capitol grounds. You're like, that's not a thesis statement, right? Like, that's a statement of fact. He's not at his conclusion yet. And so students will work through the narrative introduction that Coates provides and then work through the rest of the essay and get to what Mitch actually identified, the claim toward the end of the essay, and think about how they might use a similar structure effectively in their own writing.
Great. Well, thank you for that. And now I'm just thinking, you know, that people this question could come up too about like, so what, when you say, you talk about the old school essay, which is, you know, driven by mode and structure and perhaps limited by our conceptions of what the mode of an essay is and what the structure of an essay is. So are you arguing that we shouldn't teach the traditional words on paper essay, or what are you really saying about the role of that? And then what opportunities teachers have for going beyond that, and why they might go beyond this, what we see as the traditional words on paper essay?
Well, I think, and I'm sure my colleagues will chime in here. Part of the issue that we run into in our classrooms with that formulaic approach is that it treats every issue as a potential binary. And so many of the prompts that we offer our students are binary in nature. So many of the prompts that standardized tests offer our students are binary in nature. It's basically pick A or pick B, and then quickly come up with a few pieces of evidence that support your argument. And yet, over and over and over again, the most engaging, interesting, enlightening conversations that we have in our lives and that our students have in their lives are not binary in nature. They're conversations in which complexity is recognized and complexity is honored. And they're conversations even potentially that take place in a variety of formats that aren't necessarily just written out or just had verbally. And that's the opportunity that we have as teachers to recognize the way that students are thinking about complex issues and allowing them to bring that thinking into the classroom. And I think it's some of what Dawn has been so successful in doing in her classroom, in allowing students to and inviting students to express their responses to complex issues in multiple and different ways.
Thanks. I was thinking, Dirk, as you were talking about the notion of binary conversations, and I think to make sense, or to try to make any sense of some of the national dialogue right now, students have to be able to recognize that it's not one side or the other. In my local newspaper alone, and in my community today alone, there were three issues related to gun issues in our schools. And that the issue of school shootings, of course, is one that's on many people's minds and something that students are trying to make sense of. And so often I think people are trying to say, well, banning guns, or it's either banning guns or it's mental health, but aren't there lots of complexities tied to this issue? And so how do you make sense of that? And students are wrestling with that, adults are wrestling with that. And so when I think about everything we've been talking about, so much of it is about topics and understanding what's going on and making sense of the world that we live in. And then what are the different ways that we communicate now? And of course, part of that is written words, but also if we stop and we simply think about that one issue alone, students are involved in doing things like creating posters, visual design posters and protest posters in some instances, or media like podcasts and audio, and thinking about digital stories. So I was talking about, for instance, the Writing Your Future site tied to National Writing Project work earlier. And some of my students, when they were responding to the PBS documentary American Creed, were creating video tied to what does it mean to be an American from the Gen Z generation. And I had one student that spent time creating a whole video tied to what does it mean to be a Jewish American student or a person in 2018, and how do various people across the country see that. So they interviewed students across the country that came from the Jewish background and shared some of that together in one compilated video. It was a very, very powerful conversation. So as we think about all of that, I think there's a lot of ways for students to respond. Another, for instance, to think about is Youth Voices Live, and students across the country are having dialogue where they're producing writing and then they're talking back to each other about various issues. If you go to the website today, right now, a lot of students are writing about robots versus humans. Is artificial intelligence going to take over humanity? And then through that venue, students are involved in lots of creation opportunities, including some ties to learning on playlists, which is the LRNG work that some people have been involved with, and thinking about issues that they want to raise their voices around and different ways that we do that. And so speeches, video, audio, that's so impactful now. We know that social media is something that students are on. We know that people are on social media and having these conversations. What is the fast meme that catches someone's attention? What is the fast conversation that people post on Twitter? It's not that those other modes of communication don't matter, but we all know right now that Twitter has an impact on our society. And how do we read that and how do we write it to be active, positive, contributing citizens to our society? And that's part of the big conversation.
I think one of the things that we need to consider is the purpose of writing. And the purpose of writing is to communicate something meaningful in a way that is accessible to an audience. And bringing in some of the different modes that Dawn was talking about is a way to do that. It's a way for students to, and anybody, to communicate something that they care about, that's important to them, in a way that they can reach an authentic audience. And why do we teach writing other than to prepare and allow opportunities for our students to do this?
And I think that's such a good, I mean, Dawn, you made a lot of really great points about the multi-modes and inviting students to write in these modes and to go public in these modes that we are all experiencing. And I think it's also important not to miss what you said about reading those modes and the where they are in students' lives on a regular basis. And through this kind of, you know, critical reading as a writer, composer, as they think about making their own, you know, podcasts or videos or whatever kind of multimodal posts they make, they are able to see and read these modes in other places and think about the writing moves behind those, just as you all argue for having them think about the writing modes behind, you know, articles that they've read or other written modes.
Mm-hmm. I would also add, I appreciate everything you're recapping, is that students, I think, are more informed than they've ever been. The argument that students aren't reading and writing a tremendous amount because of technology is one that I would very much argue against. In the time of pop-up news, a news, 24/7 news that's constantly being sent to us, students are paying attention and need the support to figure out how to work through some of that. I remember when I first started teaching 13 years ago, I would say things about the news, and one of my students who was a junior said, "How do you know this?" And I said, "Well, I read the news." And of course, you know, the internet was around, people were reading news, but it wasn't in the same sense that it is now, that it's on your phone, you're sent this all the time. We know some of those conversations that are going on, and they're trying to make sense of it. And so that's so that there, I would also argue there's a shifting nature in terms of the way people are thinking about communications and English classes. And this is a very important piece of it, because I do think that not only is this about audience and purpose and authentic writing, I think it's also about what does it mean to be human and process the things around you in our world today. And I would say, this particular school year, I felt the shift in terms of what I've needed to do to help students with some very, very tough issues and how do we make sense of them.
Well, thank you for that. That's definitely a convincing argument for providing these opportunities for students and helping them deal with these think about and deal with and write about these tough issues that exist in the world and that they'll be hearing about anyway, right? So why not provide opportunities in our classrooms, going back to the point about what the classroom's really for and what the real world is. So thank you all for that. We do have a few minutes left. And so I'd open it up to any last thoughts or comments that people want to put out there as far as summary, you know, about the book and your thinking and your hope for it. Any last things that anyone would like to add?
I'll jump in with just a very quick one. And a similar thing happened in the drafting of the book itself is that by the time you get done making this argument, there isn't really enough time left to get into the fact that arguments don't even have to be nonfiction. So we found ourselves, we at a cusp where like we wanted to get that in. It's almost a whole extra book. So we have one chapter that sort of briefly gets at the fact that, you know, a poem can be an argument, a story can be an argument. So, you know, once it kind of piggybacks off the non-binary aspect, right? If an argument doesn't have to be a binary A or B, and an argument can be multimodal and take various approaches to make its point, well, then all of Kate Chopin's stories are arguments, right? Like 100%. I mean, name any piece of fiction or poetry and there's going to be an argument to play there. So we don't really have time to get into that part of the book, but just wanted to get a quick shout out to chapter 5, I think it is, that arguments can take many approaches. You know, they can be fiction, but still make an argument for the real world.
Mm-hmm. Well, and also that often those are blended because in a way, this book challenges this idea that you would separate modes anyway into like narrative, argument, informational, because I think Dirk mentioned this earlier, if you're reading a real essay and analyzing what's happening, it may begin with a narrative or personal anecdote and then move into perhaps information before getting to use of evidence and ultimately a claim. And so there's that point too that I think is worth noting, as if we're talking about real writing, there isn't this like distinction of putting them into categories in that way.
Yeah, absolutely. And you think about an essay like Coates' essay on taking down the Confederate flag, and if you removed those non-formulaic aspects from it, if you removed the narrative from it, what you would be left with, or if you imagined George Orwell's essay, if you're reading from an anthology, shooting an elephant, and just placed that argument into a formulaic structure and removed the narrative from it. So what would Orwell's three pieces of evidence be for his thesis? How ineffective the essay would be. Or Andrew Sullivan's essay from the early 2000s on hate crime legislation, the bulk of the introduction of which is taken up by narrative. And you think, man, if you took out that other mode from the essay, how radically different and probably less effectively that essay would read. And again, this is not stuff that's mysterious to us as readers or our students as readers. We are all affected by the ways in which the writers that we admire or the writers that we encounter on a daily basis use language and use the tools of rhetoric. And their toolbox is not as small as the 5-paragraph formulaic structure suggests. It's actually a much more diverse and potentially much more effective and meaningful toolbox than we tend to see.
And fun. For the students and teachers.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Well, and we're living in this marvelous time right now where we have nonfiction authors like Ta-Nehisi Coates and Malcolm Gladwell and Elizabeth Colbert and countless others who have exploded this genre in a way that is so engaging and incorporates bits of narrative with research and we need to expose our students to these. We are living in a time where there are TED Talks and podcasts and all kinds of different arguments that are being made in a variety of different ways that are authentic and engaging and that are reaching wide audiences. And as teachers, we really need to embrace this and bring our students along with us.
And I would also add that, you know, one of the things that sometimes I think stops people is the pressure of teaching and needing students to be ready for things like standardized tests. And that's one of the things we talk about a bit in the book too, is that if you're looking at things stylistically, that's actually preparing you for the conversation. The SAT writing is about writing about the rhetoric of an essay, being able to discuss that. And I also would add that, you know, we tonight have mentioned several different National Writing Project initiatives. And I think you could listen to all of this and say, wow, this is really exciting, but overwhelming. And so I would say also to other teachers is that it doesn't need to be. I love the old adage, dream big, start small, and sort of just enter that conversation. So if you're interested in, for instance, the various and the National Writing Project initiatives we've talked about, there are other resources out there. But even just having the conversation around a news article or news articles that are out there tomorrow morning and thinking about how those tie into the other things that we're discussing about our world, or they, and I'm sure they will tie into various elements of literature. Those are good starting points. So reading and discussing issues, and you can start at different levels. The College Career and Community Writing Program has so many great text sets out there to even start to think about things like technology, like start with something that's right in front of students. Are cell phones addicting? And are they changing the way we think and engage with people in our society today? And there's plenty out there to just get started with the reading and then really thinking about what the writing can be that comes out of that and the writing for impact and authenticity in terms of the work that we can do with students.
Yeah, and if I can piggyback on what Dawn so wonderfully reminded us of in terms of the conversations taking place, not just amongst our students and amongst our colleagues within our schools, but within writing project centers around the country. We are not pretending in this book that we have answers, nor are we pretending that we came up with this from scratch or out of whole cloth, and that we are essentially as writers, as teachers, as people who are attempting to engage with language in our classrooms and with opportunities to use language in our classrooms and outside our classrooms, basically not just walking in giants' footsteps, but putting on shoes that look like clown shoes when we put them on, right? Like we have been inspired by writers, teachers, and thinkers who have considered these things and continue to consider these things. And to have the opportunity to be a part of that conversation is amazing, but also those conversations continue to take place, and anyone who's in a classroom or is outside of a classroom can likewise participate in those conversations.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one time we added up the number of years of teaching experience among five authors, and it was something like 75 years. So all we're doing is, you know, it's five authors. We're a Voltron of a book here, combining all of our experiences and influences. So I think Dirk said that really very well, that, you know, none of this is necessarily a brand new idea. This is just us collecting our best practice, basically. It's very much a National Writing Project style book in that way.
Yeah, I mean, like, let's face it, Luke Skywalker would not have successfully blown up the Death Star if Han hadn't shown up at the perfect time to make it happen. But at the same time, it wouldn't have happened without Obi-Wan having taught him in the first place to trust the Force.
Well, thank you. I think that's a perfect place for us to end. And but just to say, you know, Dawn mentioned there are a lot of resources out there and initiatives, and we will certainly link in the archives of the show to all of the things that we've mentioned. But I also don't want to forget that actually you do have answers. in your book and lots of ideas for places for teachers to get started and things to try out and easy entry points for getting to see what this experience is like. And I know you all talk so much about the student experience, which is so true, and how important it is to offer them these rich experiences to publish in authentic ways and to write about things that they care about. But let's not lose what then happens for teachers when you open up your classroom in these ways, because like Mitch said, it is a lot more fun, and it changes the teaching experience and the assessment experience. Like I remember sitting down with, back when I would early on when I would teach formulaic essays about topics that kids didn't care about, and I would sit there grading, often with a glass of wine, and find myself progressively getting more and more angry at my students because I didn't like reading the stuff that I'd asked them to write. And then I have to stop eventually and realize, like, why am I asking them to write about things that I don't want to read about? And that's another really beautiful thing that happens in the classroom when you open it up to these kinds of engaging and real opportunities, is that it makes teaching easier and more fun. Students are more engaged, and their writing is much more engaging and interesting to read. So thank you all for this book and for this radio show. I know it's going to be hugely helpful to people, and all that you've said is really powerful and important for teachers and students. So thank you again for being here, and thank you to listeners for listening, and have a wonderful night, everyone.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you, Rachel.
Thanks, Rachel.
You're listening to NWP Radio, a production of the National Writing Project.
NWP.